everyone. This is Regina.
Hi, horse lovers. This is Lynn.
This week on the Horse Industry Podcast. Okay, Lynn, this week I have a couple of stories to share with you, but first I have to put them in context. So you remember the episode that we did on Helen Brock, right?
Of course.
Of course. So Helen Brock was the wealthy widow from the Brock candy fortune, and she loved her husband. But she was a bit younger than he was, and he passed away. And Helen was a little lonely at the time, and she spent some time with a man named Richard Bailey.
A gigolo.
A gigolo, which is the second time in my life I've said the word gigolo.
I just wanted to say that. Like, when you said, I'm like, oh, I get to say gigolo.
Gigolo. Again. So Richard Bailey was a gigolo. So Richard Bailey was also associated with a man named Silas Jane, who was part of the Chicago Horse Syndicate. Now, Silas Jane was a bad man. I mean, really bad man. Terrible dude.
I mean, he killed his own brother, right?
He killed his own brother, exactly. So Helen Brock was spending time with Richard Bailey because she was a little lonely. Well, Bailey was swindling Helen Brock out of money by selling her horses of little value. And she supposedly was going to go to the authorities after her trip for a routine visit to Mayo. If you remember from our episode, Helen Brock disappeared from somewhere between Chicago and Minnesota, never to be found again. Now, it was rumored that her houseman, Jack Matlick, Silas Jane, and Richard Bailey all had something to do with her disappearance. Now, if you remember, Helen Brock disappeared on February 17th of 1977, and she was declared legally dead in May of 1984. And again, her body was never found. Now, Bailey eventually was convicted of defrauding her, but essentially they could never really connect Helen to the Chicago Horse Syndicate, even though she started to catch on that there was some nefarious activity going on with Silas Jane. So that was a quick recap from that episode. Helen Brock, her story was aligned with Silas Jane. Now, Silas Jane had a brother. Technically, it was a half-brother, but we're just going to call it his brother. Silas Jane had a brother named George Jane. So today's stories kind of go down that branch of the family, not with Silas Jane, although he is connected to it, but with George Jane. So it's kind of like this organizational chart. We talked about Silas Jane and Helen Brock. Now we're going to talk about George Jane and Sherry Rood, and then also three women who disappeared from the Indiana Dunes State Park in 1966. So
you just gave me goosebumps. This is going to be so good.
Oh, it is so good. Okay, so George Jane owned a stable called Tricolor Stables. And why do you think, I tried to guess what the tricolor was for. What do you think the Tricolor Stables is named after?
You've stumped me.
I have stumped you. Okay, so I thought, oh, it must be because they like bay horses, right? Because you got black, brown, and white.
Oh, I wouldn't have gone there.
Okay, so I thought it was like tricolor. Maybe they only had horses that were white and black. I don't know. I figured it had something to do with the color of the horse. Actually, according to the Palatine Historical Society, Tricolor Stables was named for the three colored ribbons given to champions at horse shows. So that's kind of cool.
All right. I like that.
I like that. So George Jane had this Tricolor Stables. It was over 100 acres. And from what I've read, it was absolutely amazing. It had an indoor arena. It had 50 stalls down the east side. It had another 50 stalls down the west side. And then another 20 stalls on the north end. So it was just, it was huge and it was beautiful. I guess it was one of those places that you go to and you're like, oh, I would like to live my whole life here because it was amazing. Now, the south end of it had a clubhouse with a large fireplace and amazing views of the entire facility. There was even like a living quarter area or a residential part on top of the stalls or on top of the offices. And this is where like somebody could live if they were working for the stables or whatever. But anyway, it was really impressive. George Jane was married to a woman named Marion, who was also a very talented equestrian. And they were actually both judges on the different horse circuits. So, you know, they were well known. I think they had a pretty decent reputation in those circles, although it's not quite clear how good of a guy George Jane was, because his brother was Silas, and there's some...
Yeah. I mean, so you've kind of taken me down to the path where I think maybe George is okay. Silas was evil.
Silas was evil. And we are going to launch an episode in the near future where I do the research and tell you more about Silas and George. And so we can kind of make that determination down the road. But all I do know is that George was not nearly as bad as Silas was. I mean, even the George Jane and his wife, Marion, they even supported the local Girl Scout troops, and they gave away those, you know how Girl Scouts have badges? They did horsemanship badges. So,
nice.
Yeah, I mean, so there's some support there. So, okay, so now we're talking about George Jane. Well, George Jane had a young woman who worked for him, or who showed for him. Her name was Sherry Rood, or Sherilyn Rood was her name. Now, Sherry Rood actually began her show career at Silas Jane's facility, and his barn was called Idle Hours Stable. So she started with Silas. She was barely 18 years old. And according to the book, Silas Jane, Chicago's Suburban Gangster by Brian Alispa, Silas demanded sex from Sherry, and she refused. So at some point after this, Silas claimed that Sherry was a terrible rider. She just, no talent, no good, and he fired her. Well, this of course wasn't true. So Sherry went looking for a new barn to ride in, and who offers her a job?
George Jane.
Yep. At Tricolor Stables, he knew that she was talented, and he offered her a chance to ride for him. And she took it. So she had been at Silas's, and supposedly, according to the book, he made some unwanted passes at her. She turned him down. He fired her. George Jane, Silas's brother, says, "Hey, you've got talent. Why don't you come ride for me?" She takes it. This did not go over well with Silas. So here's the thing, though. Even before this, Silas Jane and George Jane, brothers, already deeply disliked each other. This made it a million times worse. So now they're going to these same horse shows, right? So they're showing the same circuit. Sherry, along with George's own daughter, are winning. I mean, they're doing really well. They're coming home with blue ribbons. They're coming home with titles, and they're beating Silas's exhibitors. The brothers literally yelled at each other at horse shows. It was an ugly scene. Every horse show. Like, can you imagine? Can you imagine going to one of your cutting shows and seeing two brothers screaming and yelling at each other all the time?
That would be awkward for everyone.
That would be awkward for everyone. And it was an ugly scene, show after show after show.
And probably a bit scary because, I mean, Silas Jane had quite the reputation as, you know, mafia, very dangerous, very cold. So I imagine that it was very uncomfortable.
For everyone.
And a bit scary for everyone.
For sure. To this point, Silas was even yelling, "I'm going to kill you," to George. I mean, literally yelling this. Now, George and his entourage, or his barn staff, or whoever went to shows with him, they literally started going to horse shows armed. Literally armed with weapons. In fact, later on, he even had bodyguards at the horse shows. And like, if he went out to the arena to watch a class, or if he was like out in public at a show, he literally would put himself in the middle of a bunch of horses so that if Silas was actually going to get a sniper and shoot him or do something terrible for him, the horses would shield him from whatever tragedy was going to happen.
That would be a terrible feeling.
It would be a terrible feeling. I cannot imagine going to a show that uncomfortable, that nervous, that...
I mean, I might stay home and hide.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so...
Move states. I might have left and gone to another part of the country.
Or go to a different circuit. There's more circuits than the... I mean, go to a different show. Like, avoid the other person,
right? So George was brave. George was brave, and he must have assumed that his bodyguards could protect him.
Or he didn't take the threats seriously.
He didn't think Silas would really do it.
Yeah. Although Silas has a bad reputation, but yeah. So he kind of I don't know. They kept doing it. They kept going to these shows. In fact, from the book by Brian Elspa, one time George was actually alone standing on the back of his trailer, like on the ramp, and Silas drove his Cadillac onto the ramp, pinning George against the back of the trailer and started issuing more threats. I think that's pretty serious. Now, George told Sherry Rood and her family that he was sure that Silas was serious with his threats. In fact, Sherry's sister reported in an article in the Chicago Tribune that months before her death, Sherry was afraid she'd get caught in the middle of the two brothers. In fact, she began carrying a loaded pistol concealed under her riding clothes or in the glove box of her car. So clearly, she was afraid. She was terrified she was going to get caught in the middle.
What job is worth that?
I don't know. The only thing I can come up with is that, you know, you try to convince yourself that, okay, I'm just being paranoid, right? I'm just being paranoid. It's nothing's going to happen, but just in case, I'm going to carry my pepper spray. You know, I'm going to walk here in the dark. It'll be fine. Nothing's really going to happen. I mean, nothing really happened until that point. So,
wow.
Yeah. So she had a sense that she might be in harm's way. Well, in the end, Sherry was right. She did get in the middle of the brothers' ugly feud, and she was killed.
Oh, that's terrible.
It's terrible. On the day that she died, Sherry had just finished painting horse jumps with another equestrian at George Silas's barn when George wanted to meet with Sherry. So I have this picture. It's like this innocent, happy day at the barn. You know, you're getting stuff done. The sun is shining. She had just painted some jumps with another equestrian, which is probably her friend. They probably had some laughs. And then shortly after that, her life comes to an abrupt end. Okay, so this is a quote from the book Silas Jane, Chicago Suburban Gangster. Quote, "It was early in June 1965 when the first lethal volley between Silas and George was fired. George had met with Cheryl Rood and they discussed the upcoming shows and the new horses that George had in his stable. In fact, he had some new horses that he wanted to show Cheryl that very morning. Once they had met at George's house, they made their way through the sunlit yard toward the barn. George was a little like his brother in that he loved Cadillacs. While George was a little more refined than his brother, he also liked to make a splash with his vehicle. Glinting in the morning sun, blocking the large doors of the barn, was George's gold Cadillac. George made his way around the side of the barn. He intended to go inside and open the barn doors. As he walked away, he smiled and tossed his keys to the beautiful young woman who had won him so much and been one of the best things his stable had ever brought on board. George had to make a phone call and intended to use a phone inside the stable. He asked Cheryl if she would be willing to move his car, perhaps closer to the house.
Don't do it. Don't get in the
car.
Stop!
While George opened the barn. As George headed inside the barn, Cheryl Lynn Rood, in her early 20s and a riding champion, strolled calmly over to George's car. She unlocked the door and climbed into the driver's seat. In the morning sunlight, she started the car and then shifted it into reverse. Just then, the sticks of dynamite strapped to the bottom of the car exploded. The explosion was terrific. Cheryl was likely killed instantly. The front of the Cadillac was blown apart. George was knocked off of his feet as he neared the side of the barn. The Cadillac was immediately engulfed in flames. Cheryl Rood never stood a chance."
What a waste of a good life.
What a waste of a good life. So yeah, I mean, what a terrible, terrible waste and loss. I mean, she was afraid and in the end, it got her.
I wonder if she just loved those horses so much mm-hmm. and was so excited about the talented horses that she was working with that she just didn't have the confidence or
I just don't
courage
think
it, to leave there.
I don't think you think it's actually going to happen. You know, I just don't think that you think it's really going to happen. Something bad would like that would happen.
So, Gina, I remember during the Helen Brock episode, Silas Jane killed a brother. His brother
yes.
was sitting at a table
yes.
playing cards with his family.
Yes.
And Silas Jane had him murdered.
Yes. This is George.
So
this is after this. In fact, when Silas found out that he killed, this car bomb that killed Sherry Rude was supposed to be for George, and he failed killing George. Now, eventually he did kill George, but this one was not the time that he did it. Instead, he apparently hired someone who killed the wrong person. So, and it's not entirely clear what caused this to happen, but literally in 1999, 34 years after Sherry died, James Blatios was found guilty of the 1965 car bombing death of this beautiful equestrian champion. He was 55 years old at his sentencing, so he was quite young when he did supposedly what he did. Now, it took more than 30 years for the police to meet with a man named Thomas Hanna. Thomas Hanna was a former used car dealer and childhood friend of Blatios's. Hanna told police that Blatios came by the dealership on the day of the murder and took a 1960 Buick LeSabre for a test drive. When Blatios returned, Hanna claimed that he reportedly was as white as a ghost, and he kept repeating that he had killed the wrong person. When Hanna asked what he was talking about, Blatios literally puked, like barfed his guts out.
Oh my goodness.
So he had terrible guilt that he killed Sherry, or that Sherry was killed and not George. Now, after the bombing, one of George Jane's daughters told detectives that she had seen a white 1960 Buick LeSabre drive into the barn area. A car matching that description was later traced to Hannah's used car dealership, and about a month later, the authorities showed up to question Hanna, who totally denied any knowledge at the time, and thus deliberately misleading the investigators. Apparently, he was just trying to protect the guy. So in 1994, however, the police started poking around again, and Hanna finally started talking. Prosecutors later alleged that Blatios was a stable hand at Silas Jane's Idle Hour Stable and was offered $10,000 for taking out George.
He probably threw up, not only because he killed that poor innocent girl, but probably because he failed his mission and he was probably so afraid of
Terrified Silas. Terrified of Silas, right.
Silas probably didn't give him, knowing what I know at this point about Silas, I'm going to guess that he probably didn't give this kid much of a choice.
Yes, I would totally agree with you. Blatios apparently contacted an acquaintance for advice on how to make a bomb, and I guess he practiced. So clearly he wanted to make sure he did it, and he did it right.
Premeditated. I mean,
Nope, it was premeditated. Yeah. And he practiced until he could get it quickly installed on a car, and then when he felt like he was totally ready, he put one on George's Cadillac, but unfortunately, it wasn't George who started the car. It was beautiful Sherry Rude, this lovely young equestrian who truly got in the middle of Silas and George's awful, bitter feud. So in July of 1999, Blatios was convicted of the murder of Cheryl Lynn Rude and sentenced to 100 to 300 years in prison. So, you know, we have Helen Brock on the Silas side. Now we have poor Sherry Rude on the George side that was murdered. And so now I'm going to tell you a story about the disappearance of three girlfriends. Two of them are 19 years old and one of them was 21. Now, you're going to be like, okay, how is this horse related? But stick with me because I'm going to connect it for you at the end, I think. So this is called the Indiana Dunes Mystery. This Indiana Dunes Mystery took place during the 4th of July weekend in 1966. So on July 2nd, 1966, three girls, Ann Miller, Patricia Blau, and Renee Brule from their Chicago area homes went to the Indiana Dunes State Park. And they were from well-to-do families. They were friends. They were looking forward to a great weekend. So Ann Miller is the one that drove. And after collecting her friends, Ann began the hour's drive from Chicago to the Indiana Dunes State Park. They stopped along the way and bought sunscreen. They arrived at the beach about 10 a.m. They made a really good-looking trio that set up shop on the beach like we've all done a million times. They had their radios, blankets, And even though there were about 9,000 beachgoers that day, they made an impression. They were memorable. Three good-looking girls, young, beautiful day. I mean, many of us grew up on Lake Michigan beaches. So it was a beautiful weekend and a very busy beach scene. Like I said, about 9,000 beachgoers. That day, the Coast Guard said there was about 6,000 boats in the water. And a couple, Mike and Francis, that was their first names, happened to land on the beach near where Ann, Patricia, and Renee made their beach spot. Mike and Francis had no idea that they were actually end up being key witnesses to the disappearance of these three friends.
Oh, no.
Right. So Renee Brule was married. Her maiden name was Slenico, and she was 19 years old. The last time she was seen, she was wearing a ruffled yellow bathing suit. Ann Miller was 21, and she was last seen wearing a two-piece blue bathing suit with a red belt. And Patricia Blau was 19, and she was last seen in her bathing suit, which was brown with green flowers and golden leaves. So the girls went there that day. It was a beautiful weekend, 4th of July. And around noon, so a couple hours after they arrived at the beach, a number of witnesses, including Mike and Francis, watch them as they entered the water in the swimsuits. Now, what's super weird is that they left all of their items behind on the beach. So they go into the lake, all their stuff's sitting right there on the beach. And the couple, Mike and Francis, shortly after that, saw the three women in the water talking to a man on a boat. And then they got on the boat.
Don't get on the boat.
Don't get on the boat.
Don't get on the boat.
They got on the boat. But what's weird is that none of the three thought to like go back and like get their ID or their wallets. I mean, their stuff was sitting there and they left it. And there was literally money in the wallet. So it's kind of bizarre why they just got on the boat, but didn't like say, hey, can you guys watch our stuff? We're going to go for a quick spin. I mean, they just got on the boat. So as the hours passed and the sun started to set, Mike and Francis began packing up to leave. At this point, those two realized that the three young women never came back and all their belongings were still there, including a purse, cigarettes, car keys, money, clothes, the radio. Everything was still there untouched. So the couple decided to collect the items and hand them over to a nearby park ranger, telling him they had last seen the women boarding a boat. Now, I would not have touched that stuff.
No, I probably would have left it, assuming, well, I mean, it's none of my business. They'll be back. Those girls are kind of careless, leaving their things behind.
Yeah.
That's what I would have done, probably.
Also, we watch enough Dateline and listen to enough crime podcasts. I don't want my fingerprints on anything.
No, because that would be destroying a crime scene.
It would be, yeah. And so they collected everything. They gave it to this park ranger and they left. Now, thinking about Mike and Francis, I would be like, red flag, red flag. I mean, that's pretty creepy that these girls are nowhere to be seen. Well, Mike and Francis, days later, would be asked to describe the boat that they saw the girls get on. They stated it was approximately 16 to 18 feet long with an outboard motor. It was white in color with a blue interior and had three hulls. I had no idea what that meant, three hulls. So I looked it up. You know, like you have those catamarans and they've got, it's almost like two parts on each side. Mm-hmm. And then the middle, it's almost like a raft, right? Mm-hmm. Well, a three-hulled boat is like a catamaran, but it's got three parts. So it's almost like a raft with rows of barrels.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's what it looks like. In other words, that's not a totally common-looking boat.
Right.
It's kind of unique.
Probably memorable.
It was memorable. So the man on that boat was described as being a white, well-tanned male with dark hair in his 20s. And there was a hunt for several days to figure out whose boat that was or where that boat was or where that boat came from. And they also looked for that man, but literally it could have been anybody that day because there is a whole bunch of tanned men in their 20s. Now, it would be actually another two more days before the rangers would realize that the items that they collected from the beach belonged to the three women who had been missed.
Oh, my.
Yeah, who had been reported missing from the Chicago area. Now, the station that took a call from Patricia Blau's father looking for information, they're kind of like, you know what? I don't know where your daughter is, but she probably had too much fun this weekend. They didn't take it that seriously. Now, he knew his daughter had visited the beach that Saturday, but he knew those girls were supposed to be home that night, and he was quite upset. So at this point, the Indiana Dunes Park superintendent remembered that those items handed in 2 days later were still in their possession. So he went back and he got it out. He saw the car keys belonging to Ann Miller, and he set out in the parking lot to locate that vehicle. He found the car in the parking lot, which is probably not a good sign. So that car had been sitting there for days, and he was able to confirm that the owner was Ann Miller, and so then he contacted authorities. Unfortunately, that delay from when the women disappeared on the beach to the search meant locating any clues would be nearly impossible. I mean, first of all, there was 6,000 people there that day. I'm sure there were just as many the next day. And think about it. It's sand and water. It's hard to have any type of evidentiary elements left in that type of an environment. So Ann Miller's car had not been moved since the trio arrived on that Saturday morning, which I think about that car sitting in the parking lot, just sitting. It's kind of creepy. I mean, it was transportation to a tragedy.
Yeah. And it seems like that should have triggered somebody's attention, like, why has this car been sitting here for that long? Or they must not have been paying for parking at that point, because she'd had a parking ticket.
Well, right. You know, and it feels like today people would be much more aware of a car that has been sitting for that amount of time. But I mean, and can you imagine parking your car and never coming back to it? So the only evidence that they found was some wreckage debris that washed up about 3 miles away from where the girls had been. But the problem was that they weren't sure how old this wreckage was. So they don't know if the wreckage was from the boat that the girls had been on, or if it was just random wreckage. And they never found additional wreckage. So not sure if that's a red herring, but they did find some wreckage days. The Coast Guard inspected reports, but they found no one had reported a missing boat, and an air patrol encompassing the area of the lake was ordered, but no further debris was discovered. So again, not sure if that debris had anything to do with it. Now, appeals were made for information on the three women, and it was not... There was a lot of people on the beach that day. And, you know, you think about being in an environment like that, and maybe you think you saw something, maybe you did, maybe you didn't. Well, there was one significant lead. There was an Indiana man who had been filming on the beach that day at around the same time the women were last seen. Now, authorities inspected the footage of the film because he turned it over. And after talking to other witnesses to corroborate it, there actually were two boats of interest on that day. The first was the same boat mentioned by Mike and Francis on the beach, and authorities seemed pretty certain that those three women had been on that boat based not only on their recollection, but on the video footage from one of the sweeping shots that man took that day. So they could like freeze it and look and go, yep, that looks like them, which is like seeing a ghost almost.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the second boat of interest was a 26 to 28 foot cabin cruiser. Now, witnesses, including a lifeguard and an Indiana lawyer, told detectives that they had seen three women climb aboard a boat with three men. Additional witnesses gave a comparable account as well. Now, these sightings actually happened later in the day. So when Mike and Francis saw them leave their stuff on the beach, it was about noon. This was later in the day, about 3 o'clock. So one theory is that the man on the smaller boat dropped off the women on the shore, then returned with his buddies in a larger cabin cruiser boat. So they don't know for sure if those two boats are connected in that way. To this day, despite the best efforts of law enforcement and investigators, there is still no trace of Ann Miller, Patricia Blau, or Renee Brule. Now, what are some of the theories? And there's a bunch of theories floating out there. Literally, there's even one theory that they were walking on a sand dune and the sand dune swallowed them up like quicksand.
that might be more acceptable for the family than what probably did happen.
Than probably didn't happen. So here are some of the theories. Now, the first theory was that there was a boating accident. The women could have very well been involved in an accident in which that boat that they were in, either the little boat or the bigger boat, crashed and led to their deaths. Now, they kind of say that's probably not the case because there was an extensive search and there was no additional wreckage found than that original wreckage that they saw 3 miles away. Also, no boats were reported missing that day and no boat captain ever came forward to say he had trouble and no boat captain ever came forward and said, hey, I'm a cool dude. I'm in my 20s. I saw these three pretty girls. I know you're looking for them. They were on my boat, but only for an hour. I let them go. Here's my alibi. Nobody ever came forward. Also, 4 bodies, if you include the boat owner, never appeared. So if there was a boat crash, you would think that sometimes, somehow, some parts of those bodies would be found.
Right, because, I mean, unfortunately, with Lake Michigan, with riptides and things like that, I mean, Lake Michigan is very dangerous and people fall off the pier, but the bodies are typically recovered.
Yeah.
The water's cold. There's no sharks that want to eat them.
Right. Like, it's Lake Michigan, not the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah. I mean, typically the bodies wash up in like from wash to shore.
Right. And so that's
especially when you're missing 4.
Exactly.
At least, I mean, 3, but probably 4 if it was some sort of an accident.
And then another twist was that maybe there was an accident and the boat owner survived, but he didn't want to admit that the other women didn't. So, but that's still a little fishy too. So, okay, so that's the first theory, that there was a boating accident. Now, the second theory is that the 3 women drown. Well, again, let's go back to the fact that there were no bodies recovered, right?
Right.
Yeah. And Lake Michigan, I mean, we know Lake Michigan can be pretty vicious. I mean, Lake Michigan's rip currents and cold waters can be a match for anybody. Those of us that live around Lake Michigan know this. Visitors have to be very careful when they swim in Lake Michigan because those rip currents can be very deadly. And like you said, it happens every year, multiple times, sadly. But the question is, again, there were no bodies discovered. So if the women were drowning, where are their bodies? Also, 2 of the 3 were reported as being exceptionally strong swimmers. So they don't think that's the case. Plus, in my mind, if 3 people are drowning and there's all those people on the beach, you don't just, I mean, not always, you can just go under and not come back up, but all 3 shouldn't just all go under. You would think you would hear them screaming or flailing, or you would think one of them would get someone's attention. Okay, so the third theory is that they wanted to start a new life, all 3 of them. Now, this is based upon a few things. First of all, a letter found in Renee Brule's belongings pointed towards the fact that perhaps she wasn't totally happy in her new marriage. She'd been married about 15 months, and in this letter that she never gave to her husband, she was kind of expressing her frustrations over the fact that he spent more time on his hobby, which was cars, than on her. Now, her family kind of said, you know what? It wasn't that big of a deal. I mean, you and I both know those first couple years of marriage may not be that easy for young couples. So people kind of poo-pooed that idea. The second one was that Ann Miller reportedly told her friends that she was 3 months pregnant. And the child's father was married. And so she was talking about maybe she wanted to go away to an unwed mother's home. So then you've got perhaps the first friend who's not necessarily happy in her marriage. The second one wants to go off to a home to have her baby. Maybe they wanted to start their new life. Now, the third friend, Patricia Blau, apparently had even told a friend that she was going to leave and that no one could find her because months prior to the disappearance, Patricia said she had bruising on her face that was due to trouble with the horse syndicate.
The horse syndicate.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. It's Silas Jane.
Silas Jane. So the horse syndicate, as we know, is that criminal network that Silas Jane was basically running or heavily involved with or kind of, steering a number of people to do nefarious activity. So according to Reddit, to add to this, Not only did Patricia say that, but the numbers of both George and Silas Jane were found among the girls' abandoned possessions. So the theory is that they either knew about the horse syndicate, or one of them knew about the horse syndicate, and they needed to be silenced so that they didn't expose them, like Helen Brock, or one or all of them saw something troubling when it came to Sherry Rood at the barn, because all three girls rode horses at Tricolor Stable.
What a connection. That's crazy.
Yep. So the potential trigger point to this theory is that in connection to a failed attempt on George Jane's life, perhaps one of the girls knew something about it or saw something about it.
Or maybe that boy that had the dynamite blabbed.
Correct. They didn't know. I mean, this, so you think about, okay, the boat crash doesn't make sense. The drowning doesn't make sense. The getting swallowed up by the sand dune doesn't make sense. Starting a new life, that doesn't really make sense either. Because
not for all three girls.
Not for all three girls. One of them would have, the families were devastated. They would have, one of them would have reached out to someone. So, you know, anyway. Sometime following that Indiana Dunes mystery, Silas Jane allegedly made a confession to a local sheriff. Although he didn't mention the women by name, he apparently did confess that three bodies were buried on his land. Now, the sheriff took this totally seriously, and he began forming plans to search the premises. However, before the search could start, the sheriff was killed in an apparent farming accident.
Oh my gosh. Silas Jane is a bad, bad dude.
Bad guy. And then after the sheriff's death, for some reason that lead was dropped and no one searched the place. What? Why would you not follow through with that?
Well, because all of the people in front of them have also died. I think you just kind of go...
Yeah. Okay, so check this out. So one person of interest in relation to Silas Jane is his known associate named Ed Neufeld. Okay. Now, the reason that Ed Neufeld is of interest in this case of the disappearance of Ann Miller, Patricia Blau, and Renee Brule is there was an insurance claim reportedly lodged several days after the girls were last seen. Neufeld supposedly notified his insurance company that a boat he owned had been destroyed in an accidental fire. Now, if this story is true, the timing of it is super fishy in relation to the missing girls. So obviously, Silas Jane is an awful human, totally awful human. And actually, the evidence is there's very little evidence that he was directly involved in these girls' disappearance. But what other explanation is there? Plus, you know, you have to think about it too. If he did this, he would have had to have known that the girls were going to the beach. It was a super busy weekend. Why would he do it in such an open place? But then on the other hand, Silas Jane really didn't care to do his bad dealings and to get in arguments with people and hurt other people in broad daylight.
Well, you know, Sherry Rood had trouble with Silas Jane trying to make advances to her. And so you almost wonder if he didn't do the same thing to these three girls or one of these girls. And so that's the reason that he got rid of them too.
Right. And it didn't really say if that one of the girls was pregnant. It didn't, and he was married.
Oh my God, it could have been Silas Jane. He really raped her. That bastard.
Okay, that is conjecture on our part, but now, according to the book Silas Jane by Brian Alispa, the investigators, and I quote, seem pretty sure that they were more collateral damage of the feud between George and Silas Jane. So it appears that investigators feel that there was a connection between Silas Jane, Sherry Rood, and the three missing women from the Indiana Dunes State Park. Okay, Lynn, so there is more to the Silas Jane story. So I feel like we've presented the story on Helen Brock from the Silas Jane side. And we've presented the story of Sherry Rood and the other three lovely women from the George Jane side. And so now in an upcoming episode, we're going to share with our listeners the story of Silas Jane and the horse syndicate. So look forward to that episode in the future where we tell the story of how Silas started, all the things that he did, including Helen Brock and Sherry Rood and potentially the three missing girls, and what happened to Silas Jane after that. So that's our story this week. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to spending more time with you and sharing stories of our industry. See you next week.